So some in the Corinthian church, remember, think that because they are saved, they exist now on a different plane from other human beings. They have graduated beyond the ordinary trifling stuff that mere mortals are occupied with. They live like angels now. And so sexual relations are not for them. Far too earthly. Far too beneath their dignity. And not just sexual relations, but even marriage itself. It too is a bit unspiritual for saved men and women. I'm saying there's an anti-marriage stance being adopted by some in this church. But if we've seen that here in 1 Corinthians 7, we've also seen something else. We've seen Paul himself being a wee bit cool, at least, towards marriage. In that section then that we looked at last time, verses 25 to 31, I mean, there you would hardly call him an enthusiastic advocate of marriage, would you? He doesn't exactly blow us away there with his gushing depiction of it. Which raises the question then, are Paul and the Corinthians actually singing pretty much from the same hymn sheet? Are they, in fact, on more or less the same wavelength? In the middle of this highly polemical, highly confrontational letter, are we going to get a brief respite here at the end of chapter 7? A ceasefire between Paul and this church? A moment of agreement where Paul says, guys, I really quite like your anti-marriage stance. It kind of chimes with my own position. Well, the answer is no. Most definitely not. Paul's position is poles apart from the Corinthians' position, as this evening's passage, when rightly understood, shows. Because don't be fooled by verse 38. In verse 38, to be sure, Paul does one more time express a certain reserve when it comes to marriage. So he who marries his betrothed does well, and he who refrains from marriage will do even better. A reserve which, for him, remember, has nothing to do with save people now being above earthly things like marriage or anything like that. His concern, rather, is that in these last days, Satan, knowing he's defeated, knowing that his time is short, Satan is engaged in frenetic activity, and he has a thing about marriages. He loves to target them. You see it in the Bible. We looked at some examples last time. You see it tragically in many evangelical churches today. Marriages being attacked and falling apart and unraveling. That's the reason for Paul's reserve. And as I said last time, the application for us is beware. Beware this enemy, Satan, who really does not like thriving Christian marriages. So yes, verse 38 is there. But don't be fooled by it. It's not representative of our text this evening. Because everywhere else in this passage, far from denigrating marriage, Paul is laying into the Corinthians' anti-marriage stance. He's showing how damaging it is. In particular, he points out in these verses three adverse consequences that it's having. Let's look at them in turn. First of all, then, their stance is encouraging anxiety. Their stance is encouraging anxiety. And this is verses 32 to 35. Now, we really need to get to grips with these four verses, because there's a standard approach to this paragraph, which in my view gets it completely wrong. According to the standard approach, Paul is himself being fairly anti-marriage here. In verses 32 to 35, he's saying something like this: marriage just creates additional anxieties for Christians. It leaves them divided. On the one hand, because they are Christians, they want to please the Lord. But on the other hand, because they are married, they want to please a spouse too. And so there's this tension going on in their lives as they are kind of pulled in two different directions. I want you, if at all possible, to be free from that. I want you to be able to enjoy undivided devotion to the Lord, verse 35. Therefore, my recommendation is remain unmarried. The standard approach, as I say, is that Paul is saying something like that. There are several problems with it. For one thing, Paul doesn't associate anxiety solely with marriage here. Verse 32, the unmarried man is anxious. Verse 34, the unmarried or betrothed woman is anxious. Paul isn't commending the unmarried state in this paragraph. He begins by saying, I want you to be free from anxieties. And he then proceeds to describe unmarried people, no less than married people, as having anxieties. Then again, if Paul is really saying that married people are divided in their devotion to the Lord, that marriage is an inevitable impediment to your relationship with Christ, then surely Paul ought not to be just a wee bit cool toward marriage. He ought to be vehemently opposed to it. Surely no Christian should enter an arrangement that necessarily pulls you away from the Lord. But Paul isn't vehemently opposed to marriage. He's entirely happy for Christians to marry. Even there in verse 38 he is. He who marries his betrothed does well. That indicates to me that Paul isn't saying here that married people are inevitably divided in their devotion to the Lord. And then just one other important point to highlight. The translation at the end of verse 35 is very misleading. I want to secure your undivided devotion to the Lord. That gives the impression that this line goes with that other line at the beginning of verse 34. There, Paul says, the married man is divided. And here he adds, and I want your devotion to the Lord to be undivided, so don't get married. But the word in verse 35 isn't in fact undivided at all. It's undistracted, as I think I read actually when I was reading the passage earlier. It's a completely different word to the one in verse 34. Now, I'll comment on its significance later, but at this point, I just want you to be aware of that misleading connection that the ESV makes between the two verses. So, as I say, the standard approach then has several problems. But what is the alternative? If Paul is not warning about the anxieties that marriage creates, what is he saying here? Well, let me try to explain. When he refers to all these anxious people, unmarried men who are anxious, married men who are anxious, unmarried women who are anxious, married women who are anxious, when he refers to all these anxious people, he's describing the actual situation in the Corinthian church. He's saying right now, in your congregation, there are all these anxieties swirling around. And he's saying the reason for that is this vocal element in the church that's against marriage. That's saying marriage is no estate for saved people. That's the cause of the anxieties. The anti-marriage stance is to blame. How is it? Well, he says it has left unmarried folk anxious about how to please the Lord. I can only please the Lord if I remain unmarried. Therefore, I mustn't marry. I mustn't marry. I really, really mustn't marry. Any desires I have to marry must be suppressed. And if, in fact, pleasing the Lord means denying myself marriage, then perhaps it means denying myself all sorts of other this worldly things too. Perhaps my possessions are a problem and they need to go. Perhaps my enjoyment of good food and drink is a problem and that needs to go. You can see how the unmarried in the Corinthian church are being damaged by this stance, this anti-marriage stance. And then again, Paul says that the anti-marriage stance has left married folk anxious. Married folk anxious about how to please their spouses. How do I pay careful attention to pleasing my spouse without sinning? Without being thereby chained to this life when I'm supposed to be leading an angelic kind of existence now? There at the beginning of verse 34, the Greek doesn't actually say of the married man his interests are divided. It just says he is divided. Perhaps torn would be an even better way of rendering it. The guy's torn as to whether pleasing his wife is the right thing, or whether in fact he should just be focusing on pleasing the Lord and not bothering about his wife. And you can see then how the married in the Corinthian church are also being damaged here by this stance. It's creating anxieties all round. That's what Paul is saying. And having described then this unhappy situation that's prevailing in the church, in verse 35, Paul distances himself from the anti-marriage brigade. I refuse, he says there, to lay any restraint upon you. I'm not going to tell you to marry. I'm not going to tell you to remain unmarried. I'm not going to restrain anyone in either way. My concerns are, number one, good order, as the ESV has it there. Or perhaps better, what is appropriate. That's really what Paul says. For some Christians, being married is appropriate. For some Christians, being unmarried is appropriate. It just varies from person to person according to how God has wired us up. And number two, what concerns me is your undistracted devotion to the Lord. That is undistracted by anxieties. I don't want you to be anxious that you can only please the Lord by remaining unmarried. I don't want you to be anxious that you can't properly please the Lord because you are married. It doesn't matter whether you're married or not. It isn't your married or your unmarried status that will prevent you serving the Lord fully. It's your anxieties about your married or unmarried status. Your anxieties that these anti-marriage folk are creating, those anxieties are what will distract you from devotion to Christ. So be free from them, Paul is saying. Be free from them. Don't worry. Whether you're married, whether you're not married, just get on with loving and serving the Lord. So I hope you get this paragraph then, that so often I think misunderstood. Paul isn't saying marriage creates anxieties. He isn't recommending singleness instead. He's saying those who teach that one status is more holy than the other, they create anxieties. That's what he's saying. And if in Corinth then it was being conveyed that singleness is more holy than marriage, perhaps in our evangelical context today the tendency is in the opposite direction. It can be at least, I think, tacitly conveyed that marriage is more holy than singleness. All those books in the Christian bookshops about being a godly husband, being a godly wife, being a godly family, they tacitly convey perhaps sometimes that marriage is a more holy status than singleness, so that the unmarried Christian could get anxious. I can't properly serve the Lord like that woman who has a husband to love, or that woman who has children to raise. And Paul would say to such a person, no. Your unmarried status doesn't remotely inhibit your capacity to please the Lord. What will inhibit your capacity, however, is your anxiety about it. That will distract you. So don't be anxious. Just get on with undistractedly being devoted to the Lord. This is the first thing then this evening. Their stance, this anti-marriage stance that's prevailing in Corinth, it's encouraging anxiety. Secondly, their stance is encouraging compulsion. Their stance is encouraging compulsion. This is verses 36 and 37. So in verse 36, then Paul addresses the betrothed man. And he begins then, if anyone thinks that he is not behaving properly towards his betrothed, by not behaving properly, he probably means that you have kept her in this betrothal arrangement for a long period of time without yet actually marrying her. And that's not really fair on her. That's probably what he means by that. He continues, if his passions are strong, he means by that you really desire her as your wife. In those circumstances, he concludes, marriage should take place. Then in verse 37, however, he turns to an alternative scenario. A scenario in which the betrothed man decides not to marry the woman. I know that last phrase of verse 37 is a little bit confusing. Keep her as his betrothed. That sounds, doesn't it, as though instead of marrying her, he's just going to kind of keep her in this perpetual state of engagement, of betrothal. But remember that throughout verses 25 to 38, the word translated betrothed is literally virgin. You can see that in the ESV footnotes. And betrothed is normally the right the better translation in this passage. But at this point, I think the word probably reverts to its most basic meaning. The man here decides that in relation to him at least, she will remain a virgin. She may, of course, go on and marry someone else instead, but in relation to him, she'll remain a virgin. In other words, they won't get married. That's simply what he's decided. He's decided that the marriage won't take place. He's not going to wed his betrothed. So you get that scenario, I hope, there in verse 37. This man deciding not to marry this woman to whom he has been betrothed. But the really striking thing in verse 7, surely, is the sheer emphasis on this being a free decision by the man. I mean, you can't miss that, can you? Paul piles up here no fewer than four separate phrases. Whoever, phrase number one, is firmly established in his heart. Phrase number two, being under no necessity. Phrase number three, having his will, is better, under control. Phrase number four, determined in his heart. He's really emphatic. This has got to be a free decision by the man. Why this emphasis? Well, presumably because potentially a betrothed man in the Corinthian church might end his relationship with the woman not really because he wants to, but because he feels pressure from these anti-marriage folk who are so vociferous in the church. He feels, in other words, a kind of compulsion. And Paul then is passionately opposed to that. He's passionately opposed to this man having to break his betrothal because he's under compulsion from others in the church to do so. Why is Paul so passionately opposed to that? Well, because Christians should never be under compulsion. You must behave like this and not like that, because behaving like that would be sinful. Christians must never be under such compulsion unless that compulsion is from Jesus Christ himself in his word. That's a basic principle that you find often, don't you, in Paul's writings, whether it's in actually the next section of 1 Corinthians chapters 8 to 10, which we looked at a few years ago, whether it's in Romans 14, other places as well. Paul is passionate. A Christian must never be under compulsion. That course of action is okay, that course of action is sinful, unless Christ himself is the one compelling it here in the Bible. No one else has the right to compel a Christian. And this betrothed man then in Corinth, he's not under any compulsion from Christ to end the betrothal. Christ hasn't said anything about it. And therefore, he's free. Therefore, he's free. Paul is emphatic about that. And you then, believer, you aren't under compulsion from Christ to be teetotal. You aren't under compulsion from Christ to homeschool your children. You aren't under compulsion from Christ to only listen to classical music. You aren't under compulsion from Christ to only read Christian authors. Therefore, you are free. If Christ hasn't compelled you in those areas, you are free. So don't come under anyone else's compulsion in any of those areas. To be sure, choose any of those things for yourself if you wish. That's fine. If you think there are good reasons to go down any of those routes, then choose them for yourself, but don't come under anyone else's compulsion in any of those areas. And equally, believer, don't seek to compel anybody else. Don't seek to compel anyone else to emulate your decisions in those areas or other similar areas where Christ has not legislated in his word. Your decisions on those matters may be very wise ones. And to be sure, you can share advice with your brothers and sisters. Well, this is the approach I've taken in this particular area where the Bible hasn't actually said anything explicit. This is the approach I've taken. You might want to consider it. But you cannot compel. You cannot say you be sinning if you make a different decision to the one I've made. We mustn't put pressure on our brothers and sisters like that. We mustn't give the impression ever that if you're a really God-honoring Christian, then you'll toss away your television. If you're a really God-honoring Christian, then you'll stop celebrating Christmas. Or whatever it might be. In that case, you are setting yourself up as a rival authority to Jesus Christ. You're saying, Jesus, you should really have put this in your word as well, you know. I don't know why you missed it out. That's what we're doing when we compel our brothers and sisters on matters where Christ has not explicitly legislated. And so, let's be clear on this, all of us. It is Christ's prerogative to define what is sinful, what is unrighteous, what is wrong, what is unacceptable. And he has only done that here in this book. He won't add to what he's done here. He won't create new rules conveyed through a dream or a vision or a sudden moment of inspiration that somebody has. Here is where he has defined what is sinful, what is unrighteous. And what he has not labeled that, you and I have no right to label that. Let's be passionate like Paul was on this matter of Christian liberty. Let's not be compelled by overbearing brothers and sisters. And let's not be overbearing brothers and sisters. So this stance then in the Corinthian church, this anti-marriage stance, for one thing it's encouraging anxiety, and then for another thing it's encouraging compulsion, but then thirdly and finally this evening their stance is encouraging divorce. Their stance is encouraging divorce, and this is verses 39 and 40. And we've seen this already then in this series. This is why Paul had to write what he wrote back in verses 10 and 11 of the chapter. To the married, I give this charge. The wife should not separate from her husband. But if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And the husband should not divorce his wife. And this then is a consequence, it seems, of this anti-marriage stance in the Corinthian church. Some are even being so influenced by that they're ending their marriages. And Paul is so concerned about it that he doesn't just address it once there in verses 10 and 11, but right at the very end now of chapter 7, he briefly returns to it. And we don't need to linger then. We don't need to really say anything more about that matter of divorce, because we did talk about it a few weeks ago when looking at verses 10 and 11. But just notice that Paul does clarify here something that he didn't in verses 10 and 11. That though divorce doesn't, in God's eyes, dissolve a marriage and permit remarriage, except in the case of divorce for adultery, Jesus says, death does. Death does, in God's eyes, dissolve a marriage and permit remarriage. Because Paul says a wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives. But if her husband dies, she is free to be married to whom she wishes. Actually, this is another area, I think, where we must leave Christians as free as Jesus Christ leaves them. Because while I guess no one would in our circles ever prohibit a Christian widow or Christian widower remarrying, I think it can sometimes be viewed with a degree of suspicion. Well, a really loyal husband, a really loyal wife wouldn't marry again after the spouse's death. It's a bit cheap. It's not really in the spirit of Christian marriage. We've no right to be disapproving like that. One might not be able to countenance doing it oneself, but one has no right to be disapproving of others who do remarry in such circumstances. Christ is not remotely suspicious of the remarrying widow or widower. He doesn't grudgingly tolerate such behavior. He's unequivocal here through his apostle. She is free to be married to whom she wishes, he says. And in our attitude then toward the bereaved spouse who remarries, we must take our cue from Jesus Christ himself. Notice though that the freedom Christ gives that person, although great, is not absolute. He says through Paul, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. In other words, this person then that the widow or widower marries must be a believer. That's what Paul means by only in the Lord. Which cannot surely be a rule which only applies to Christian widows or widowers. It must apply to any Christian considering marriage, whether they've been married before or not. A Christian should only marry in the Lord. That, I think, is a rock-solid inference from verse 39 here. A Christian should only marry another Christian. And that's an important point, isn't it, given what Paul has said earlier here in this chapter. Because remember, he's talked then, hasn't he, earlier about a Christian who is married to an unbeliever, presumably because that Christian has become a Christian after getting married. And the spouse still isn't a Christian. The spouse is still an unbeliever. And remember how Paul has been very encouraging there to the believing spouse, stay in the marriage if at all possible. Keep the marriage going if at all possible. And he's actually specifically, we said, given that believing spouse this incentive, you staying in the marriage might result in the spouse being saved. It really might. But you see, someone could infer from that, well, in that case, a Christian can marry a non-Christian and it might result in the person being saved. It's a good thing to do. It's a good evangelistic strategy. But this verse then, verse 39, it emphatically dismantles that inference. That is a wrong inference. Don't choose an incongruous marriage of that kind, Paul says here. Yes, if you find yourself in one because you've become a Christian after marriage, then don't worry. There are reasons for encouragement in that situation. But if you are unmarried, do not, whatever you do, choose an incongruous marriage of that kind. Rather, marry in the Lord. It's a lovely phrase, that, isn't it? Marry in the Lord. He could have put it more prosaically. Marry a believer. Marry a Christian. But marry in the Lord. And I think, and I'll close on this note, I think it confirms, actually, the wrongness of what I called the standard approach to that first paragraph we considered this evening, verses 32 to 35. Remember I said that there's a standard approach to that paragraph which goes like this: although certainly permitted, marriage is not optimal for the Christian. It's not optimal because it means that you're divided between pleasing the Lord and pleasing your spouse. Now, that thinking kind of assumes, doesn't it, that there's some great gulf between the Lord and your spouse. They are poles apart, so that you can only possibly please one of them at the expense of the other. But if, as ought to be the norm then, Paul is saying here in our text now in verse 39, if, as ought to be the norm, your spouse is in the Lord, then there's no great gulf between the Lord and the spouse, and pleasing the one and pleasing the other. There couldn't, in fact, be a closer connection between these two persons in your life, your spouse and the Lord, if your spouse is in the Lord. Now, if you're married to an unbeliever, then certainly there is a real division. In that case, the first most important relationship in your life is with Christ, and the second most important relationship in your life is with an enemy of Christ. And that's messy. And that's unsatisfactory. And again, then, if you're an unmarried Christian this evening, I urge you, do not ever marry an unbeliever. Whatever romantic chemistry may exist, don't do it. Don't go there. Don't allow that deep division to fracture your life, whereby you're juggling Christ on the one hand with this person on the other hand whose destiny is to be Christ's footstool. But if your spouse is in the Lord, I'm saying there's no such division. Remember what Peter says to husbands in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 7. What he says to husbands there about their believing wives, he says, they are heirs with you of the grace of life. Your spouse is an heir with you of the grace of life. There's this harmony between the two great loves of your life. Yes, of course, they're not equal. Christ comes first, certainly, emphatically. Always, he must come first. But there's a congruity between the two because your spouse is in the Lord, in Christ. And I close then just challenging those of you who are in a Christian marriage to prove the standard approach to that first paragraph wrong. Prove it wrong in your lives. The standard approach is that if you're married, then inevitably there's going to be a pull. And pleasing your spouse will mean not fully pleasing the Lord. And I challenge you to prove that interpretation incorrect. And show then by your flourishing relationship, both with your spouse and with the Lord, that standard approach is complete and utter nonsense. That when your spouse is a Christian, you can please him or her, and precisely by doing that, amongst many other things, you can please fully Jesus Christ. May God help us. Amen.